Hello, welcome to the Saturn edition of your local talking newspaper, covering St Albans and the surrounding district. This edition is for the week ending July the 13th, 2019. I'm Jenny, one of your readers for tonight, and I'm joined in the studio by Liz, John and Alison. The piece of music you've just heard is called The Goldfinch, and we'll play all of it at the end of the recording. As usual, our thanks go to Goffby, who composed the music and has given us permission to use it. All the news items in this recording have been taken from the Hearts Advertiser, and we will finish with a summary of the radio programmes we think you might enjoy over the next week. Here is Liz with the first item.
A St Albans pub will rise from the ashes after suffering a devastating fire over the weekend. Hearts Fire and Rescue Service rushed to the Plough, Sleepside, in Sleepside Lane at about 4 a.m. on Sunday, July the 7th, after a passerby saw the flames and called 999. Firefighting crews from St Albans, Welwyn Garden City, Boreham Wood, Watford, Rickmansworth and Hemel Hempstead attended the scene and the blaze was out by about 6 a.m. It is believed to have been caused by an electrical fault with a household appliance, although the insurer is still conducting investigations. A fire door protected the main pub building, so only the kitchen and shed storage area were ravaged by flames. Co-owner of the pub, Sean Hughes, has estimated that the damage repairs will soar into tens of thousands of pounds. The pub has been open under its current ownership for less than a year. Sean acquired the business after successfully establishing Dillon's The King's Arms in St Albans city centre. The Plough reopened in August 2018 after a major refurbishment of the site, which includes a primary alehouse dating back to 1690. Sean said firefighters told him the thatched roof was only moments away from being engulfed. He said, "We have a thatched roof and the flames were so high they were right next to the main building. We are exceptionally lucky and we are so grateful for the support." Sean's brother Tim and his fiancée, Rachel Doherty, both live on the premises but were unhurt. "They are safe, they got out just in time, and the fire brigade were incredible. They got out here so quickly," Sean said. The Plough's bar should reopen by the middle of next week, but the kitchen will be out of action for a significantly longer period. However, Sean said an outside kitchen may be able to serve barbecue food in the meantime. In a post on Facebook, the Countryside Pub thanked firefighters for saving the historic building. It said, "We are completely shocked to say that we have had a devastating fire at the Plough early this morning, but thanks to the incredible fire brigade, we have saved the main building. Both Tim and Rachel are safe, but obviously in shock." This announcement was met with an outpouring of sympathy on social media. One poster said, "Devastating. So much love and hard work put into this beautiful pub, thinking of you all." Another added, "I'm so sorry to hear this dreadful news. You have an amazing place there and it will be again. As soon as you are ready, we will all be back spending money." Other comments included, "Thank God everyone is okay," "Desperately upset," "Love your positive spirit," and "At least everyone is safe." Since Sean jointly took over the Plough, it has been battling setbacks. It could not open during the heatwave in 2018 because of a gas installation problem. Sean said, "We missed the really hot summer of last year, so we were looking forward to getting in and having a really good time this year, and the summer has only just started." He encouraged everyone to get an effective fire door.
The next story is personal trainer in 36-hour cycle ride for baby charity. A St Albans man will cycle for 36 hours straight to raise money for a baby charity. Anthony Powell, who's 42 and lives in Flamstead, will cycle 1 million metres on Tuesday, July 23rd, to raise money for baby bank charity Little Village, which provides second-hand baby clothes and equipment. He was inspired to take part in the challenge by his 13-year-old daughter, Sophia, who lives in South London and whose mum, Angela, volunteers for the charity. Anthony, who lives with his wife, Dr. Camilla Powell, and two young daughters, works as a personal trainer at Nuffield Health Gym in Hemel Hempstead, where he'll be completing the challenge on a fixed watt bike. He'll cycle all day and night, cycling the equivalent distance from London to the top of Scotland, only stopping to go to the toilet and grab refreshments. Anthony said, "I like to set myself tough physical challenges. I'm also keen to raise money for a good cause. My daughter is passionate about Little Village as her mum volunteers there and she's seen the difference they make to families struggling to make ends meet. So she suggested I raise money for them. My wonderful wife and colleagues from Nuffield Health will be with me throughout the night to give me lots of encouragement, so that will definitely help me keep going. And there are big TV screens in front of the bikes, so I'll be watching movies to distract me and keep awake." Through his cycle, Anthony hopes to raise £10,000 for the charity and estimates he'll burn 20,000 calories, the equivalent of running 8 marathons. Little Village CEO Sophia Parker said, "What Anthony is doing is incredible. I was speechless when I heard how far he's planning to cycle and how much he's hoping to raise for Little Village. Little Village receives little public funding and is very much reliant on the kindness of people like Anthony to help us to keep our doors open in order that we can support growing numbers of families. This fundraiser will make a huge difference, so I'm very grateful to Anthony, Sophia and everyone who is sponsoring and supporting him." And there is a picture of Anthony on a bike smiling. Whether he will be after 36 hours, I'm not so sure.
My first story has the headline, "Tough crackdown on child trafficking across the county in Europe-wide operation." 5 men from St Albans, Potter's Bar and Stevenage have been arrested as part of a Europe-wide crackdown on child trafficking exploitation. Hearts Police carried out the operation from June the 17th to the 23rd during Europe-wide Operation Week Impact. A total of 25 warrants were sent across the area in Hemel Hempstead, Stevenage, Watford, Radlett, Abbots Langley, Broxbourne, Boreham Wood, St Albans, Harpenden, Wellen, Hertford and Barnet. From this, 6 arrests were made. 2 18-year-old men from Stevenage were arrested on suspicion of online grooming of a child. A 30-year-old man from St Albans was arrested on suspicion of possessing indecent images of children. A 27-year-old man from Potter's Bar was arrested on suspicion of immigration offences. A 21-year-old man from Potter's Bar was arrested on suspicion of immigration offences. And a 44-year-old man from Watford was arrested on the suspicion of possessing indecent images of children. 5 voluntary interviews were also conducted by Hearts Police. The Modern Slavery Unit, Operation Tropic, conducted the operations to stop child trafficking and exploitation of under-18s. Hearts Police were supported by the Child Online Safeguarding Team, HALO, Sexual Exploitation of Children and Young People Teams, and officers from the Special Constabulary, Hartsmere Intervention, Eastern Region Special Operations Unit, Essex Police, Hartsmere Borough Council and Immigration and Border Control. The Potter's Bar operation, with Hartsmere Intervention officers, was emphasised by Hearts Police as raising awareness locally about the signs of trafficking, particularly by businesses. Major transport hubs and businesses were also identified as potentially being involved in child trafficking as part of the operations.
This small article is about illegal immigrants. A refrigerated lorry containing 13 illegal immigrants was stopped by police in St Albans. Police were called at 7:37 p.m. on Tuesday, July the 2nd, to reports of noises that were coming from within the trailer of a lorry in Lion Way. 13 illegal immigrants were found inside. The group were taken to an immigration centre and one man was taken to hospital for treatment. A 16-year-old boy who was also in the lorry was referred to social services and is currently being looked after. The lorry was refrigerated to store the goods it was carrying.
A St Albans-based home care provider has received an overall outstanding rating from the Care Quality Commission. Home Instead Senior Care St Albans was given an outstanding rating for being caring and well-led, with a good rating for being safe, effective and responsive. Inspectors observed that people who used the service were truly respected and valued as individuals and empowered as partners in their care in an exceptional service. The organisation, led by Fiona and Nick Harrell, provides at-home care and companionship that enables older people to continue living independently for as long as possible. Fiona and Nick said, "We are so pleased to have had the hard work of our dedicated team recognised in this way. We do our best to ensure that high-quality care is provided to every client and that Home Instead positively benefits the St Albans community."
A ribbon-cutting ceremony has been held to celebrate the official opening of a St Albans nursing home. Alban Manor Nursing Home in Cheney Drive was acquired as a nursing home in February, and Mayor of St Albans Councillor Janet Smith and MP Anne Main attended the official opening last month. Managing Director Parminder Gruhl spoke at the ceremony and emphasised the home's facilities. She said, "We have some really fun and innovative features, such as the Zen Wellness Centre for Yoga and other rehab therapies. We also have a hydrotherapy spa, our own post office and village store, our own film house to catch up with the latest blockbusters, as well as the golden oldies. And most importantly, we have our very own pub, The George. We see our role as of supporting and enabling our residents to be as independent as they can possibly be."
St Albans police officers have been awarded for outstanding work. Seven officers and two staff members were recognised for their contribution to policing by Chief Inspector Linda Coates this week. Officers across the Community Safety Partnership nominated colleagues for the award. The highest accolade, the 1836 Award, was presented to Detective Sergeant John Green by the Very Reverend Dr. Geoffrey John for his hard work, commitment and professionalism. Detective Sergeant Ben McGregor from the local crime unit was awarded the Crime Management Award. PC Rich Oakley received the Intervention Officer Award, and leadership awards went to Intervention Sergeant James Pickering and Rural Neighbourhood Sergeant Jordan Fox. PC Ben Kirby and PCSO Lena Bogaita were joint winners of the Safer Neighbourhood Team and Community Safety Unit Officer Award for demonstrating an exceptional contribution through the use of problem solving to deliver community resolutions. Bob Gunning was recognised for his voluntary service with the police. He reviews burglary data and spikes in crime to spot trends and patterns.
This next piece is entitled "What's the Rationale Behind Erosion of the Greenbelt?" Planning inspectors have raised serious concerns about St Albans' local plan. Examining inspectors Elaine Worthington and Louise Crosby sent a letter to St Albans District Council, SADC, highlighting problems with the housing document, which is due to be scrutinised in October. They said SADC did not sufficiently justify some of its policies or explain how it chose vast amounts of greenbelt land for development. About 15,000 new houses have been proposed to be built in the district before 2036, with 10 large settlements on protected sites. The inspector said SADC should follow a two-stage approach when proposing substantial greenbelt boundary alterations. They advised, "Together, these steps give a scale of unmet need, which could only be met by greenbelt release, and are necessary to determine whether the review of the greenbelt is justified in principle." SADC had until 12 p.m. on Tuesday to respond to the letter, which advises that the authority may need to consult further and examination dates pushed back. Redbourne Parish Council Chairman, Councillor David Mitchell, said he'd been voicing these concerns since it was revealed that a lot of greenbelt is being sacrificed near the village. He said, "I've been arguing on behalf of Redbourne Parish Council that they, SADC, haven't done this work, and they said they have, and we responded, 'Well, where is the evidence to back it up?' When the inspectors themselves are saying that it needs a lot more work, that's very serious." Last March, then Housing Secretary Sajid Javid threatened to take over the St Albans local plan process if SADC did not submit a document by this March. Councillor Mitchell believes the tight deadline forced SADC's hand. They rushed to get it all done by March because they felt under pressure by government, and now it's a dog's dinner and Redbourne is the scapegoat for all the housing. Portfolio holder for planning at SADC, Councillor Jamie Day, said he was expecting inspectors to ask questions. We'll be responding in detail to all the issues raised by the inspectors by July 31st. I'm confident that we have answers to all of their questions. In particular, we can provide a full justification for selecting a number of broad locations for housing, commercial and infrastructure development. The letter was discussed by SADC Planning Committee on Tuesday. A Spatial Planning Manager at SADC, Chris Briggs, said it is normal to be asked questions of the submitted document. Councillor Malachi Pakenham said, I have read the inspector's letter in detail and I find one or two issues flagged up in there and I appreciate the officers are going to respond to be slightly concerning. I am by no means an expert in this field, and Mr. Briggs says the letters like this are not uncommon, but if you look at some of the threads weaving through it, I get a sense of unease. Head of Planning and Building Control at St Albans and District Council, Tracy Harvey, said the reason for opting for large sites over smaller parcels was so new, infrastructure could be secured. At the meeting, there was also a clash between former planning portfolio holder Councillor Mary Maynard and her successor, Councillor Day. She asked if the new Liberal Democrat administration intends to increase the number of affordable homes in the local plan and include that in the response to the inspector. When Councillor Day said that they're still working on the corporate plan, Councillor Maynard retorted that the corporate plan does not include affordable targets. Councillor Day said, sorry, the corporate plan we are working on within our group didn't really go anywhere. Interrupting Councillor Maynard said, Chair, I'm asking you when you respond to the inspector, do you intend to change the targets for affordable housing in the local plan? It's quite a simple question. You said you would. Do you intend to? If so, what's it going to be? He replied, as I said, we're still talking about it in the Cabinet, so we haven't got an exact figure. I can't decide on my own. It's a Cabinet decision. When we have that figure, obviously we will publish it. Councillor Maynard addressed the room. Can I point out to my colleagues that this is not actually a Cabinet decision? It is a Council decision. The meeting chair said, I'm not going to give you a figure off the top of my head before we have discussed it in our Cabinet, which we will then put forward to the Council. Councillor Maynard thanked Councillor Day for illuminating the situation clearly.
And here is another article about the housing development. Proposals for a large development near Redbourne have been revised after a public consultation. Laws Agricultural Trust, LAT, and Ross Hampstead Research first proposed a housing development on its land to the northeast of Redbourne as part of the St Albans local plan call for sites in 2018. The site, on fields known as Black Horse, Bylands, Meadow, Osier and Ver, were rejected by St Albans District Council, SADC, for inclusion in the local plan. But this has not deterred LAT and Ross Hampstead Research. In November last year, the organisations held a public consultation and have now refined its proposals. Half of the 825 home site would be developed and the remaining land earmarked for a public river valley countryside park. 40% of the houses would be truly affordable, alongside a new two-form entry primary school, a cycleway linking the Harpenden and Redbourne sections of the Nicky Line, and a new 75-space car park for Redbourne High Street. 70% of the affordable housing will be low-cost rented, with priority given to local people. There would be community facilities buildings which could be used as a doctor's surgery, meeting room or employment area. Chief Executive of LAT, Peter Oxley, said, "Following our public consultation event in November last year, we have been taking the feedback received on board and refining the proposals. At our events, which we're holding in July, we're looking forward to showing residents changes we have made to the proposals following this feedback. I'd like to reiterate what I said at the time of the last consultation. At the Trust, we have a clear vision for the whole site and how it can complement Redbourne. To put it simply, this is not just about building homes. Residents can view the revised proposals at public exhibition in Redbourne Village Hall on July the 9th from 4pm to 8pm and July the 10th from 12pm to 4pm. These plans are still not included in the St Albans local plan, which is due to be scrutinised by inspectors from October the 14th to 25th at the SADC Chamber in the Civic Centre at St Peter's Street."
We heard a story earlier praising firefighters, so an interesting headline: fire service cuts spark anger as crews reduced. Hertfordshire County Council will cut the size of fire crews from 5 to 4. The Cabinet voted in favour of the plans at a meeting on Monday, following a 3-month public consultation which ended in March. Labour County Councillor for Stevenage, Joshua Bennett-Lovell, who along with Councillor Joan King were the only two to vote against the plans at the committee level on June 30th, questioned the safety of reducing traditional fire crews at the meeting prior to Cabinet vote. The concern was further echoed by Hertfordshire Fire Brigade's Union Secretary Darren Scotchford after the June meeting, who called for a further review of the plan. The FBU have significant concerns with a number of proposals contained within the draft plan, he said. The plans, outlined as part of a package of plans for the future of the Hertfordshire Fire and Rescue Service, known as IRMP, earlier this year, has prompted fears that the public and firefighters could be put at greater risk. "We are particularly concerned that despite widespread public opposition to reducing crew sizes from 5 firefighters to 4 on frontline appliances, the IRMP still proposes this reduction," said Mr. Scotchford. "We would urge the County Council to think again on this and other proposed cuts, as we believe they will be to the detriment of both firefighters and the public's safety and welfare. Our members are prepared to defend their service, and all options to achieve this remain on the table." Reported incidents have been increasing in recent years, with crews going to a total of 1,216 in the Welwyn Hatfield and Potters Bar area, 2,172 in North Harts, and 874 in St Albans in 2017-18. But the revised IRMP argues that having a crew with 4 firefighters is appropriate and cost-effective. It says the vast majority of appliances in the county are already crewed with a maximum of 4, and suggests that reducing the size of crews may even improve cover in some areas of the county. It says by officially adopting this policy, we can take an holistic view of the service and deploy spare capacity across the organisation, including to on-call stations. This will then provide a better and more even spread of firefighters across the entire county, which will significantly improve our daytime fire cover in more rural areas. The IRMP stated that trying to crew an engine with a certain number of firefighters can lead to an inflated response to serious incidents, meaning if 60 personnel are required to go to a scene at any one time, a total of 248 personnel can actually be used for the whole response. Cabinet Member for Community Safety Terry Hone said on the IRMP being approved, "We want to continue to improve as an organisation to make sure we are meeting the changing needs of our communities and to mitigate the risks they face." Liberal Democrat County Councillor for St Albans, John Hale, said at the June 30th meeting everybody was concerned that the crews' changes to crewing should go without event or incident, and that they would want to make sure there were appropriate numbers for the safety of the public and for fire officers. Hearts Deputy Chief Fire Officer Chris Bigland also asked the panel to trust their professional judgment, which was based on evidence. Since the proposals in the IRMP were first made public in December, there have been public consultation and open meetings. Most of the 120 who responded to the consultation, 58.6%, said they disagreed or strongly disagreed with the plan to reduce the crew size. It was also reported to the meeting that just 49 people had attended the 3 public meetings held in Watford, Berkhamsted and Hertford. The relatively low turnout was highlighted by Conservative County Councillor for North Arts, Simon Bloxham, himself a former firefighter, who suggested people not turning up may indeed be a signal they were quite happy with the plans in the IRMP. Meanwhile, the Cabinet also backed the trial of a new rapid response vehicle, which would have a crew of three at Watford Fire Station. This would be in addition to the two existing Watford fire engines.
And now from the fire service to hospitals, with an article with the headline, Hospitals' Futures to be Discussed by Bosses. Meetings are being held today to consider the plans for the future of hospitals in West Harts. West Harts Hospital Trust, or WHHT for short, and Harts Valley's Clinical Commissioning Group, or HVCCG for short, are holding two separate board meetings to consider the Draft Strategic Outline Case, or SOG for short, for transforming hospital sites in Watford, St Albans and Hemel Hempstead. The draft SOC will make the case for the Trust and the CCG's preferred option, known as Option 1, which is to renovate existing hospital sites rather than build a new A&E hospital central to West Harts. This option provides the greatest amount of investment in Watford General Hospital, with some refurbishments and enhancements at St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead. Some campaigners, however, continue to argue that a new hospital in a central location would better serve the growing population. WHHT and HVCCG previously ruled out building a new hospital after being given a £350 million spending limit by the government. Campaigner Andy Love said, St Albans City Hospital has been drastically reduced in size since its heyday as an A&E hospital and is in desperate need of far more than the £38 million of funding on offer within Option 1. St Albans residents will know that in emergencies and for many of their appointments, treatments or surgery, they will be taken to Watford General Hospital, which will be the scene of major reconstruction for many years if the Trust get their way. Residents needing to attend Watford General who are without a car face a long journey by bus and having to change in Watford Town Centre. Once at the hospital, patients and visitors have to cope with the steep gradient that the hospital is built on, and for the disabled and elderly, this is a real challenge. WHHT is holding a meeting from 9am to 10:30am at the Executive Meeting Room in the restaurant at Watford General Hospital. HVCCG will meet from 2pm to 4pm at Stanborough Centre, 609 St Albans Road in Watford.
This piece is about Luton Airport. Campaigners accuse Luton Airport of ignoring the major sources of pollution. Airport campaigners are concerned that greenhouse gas emissions from Luton are causing significant harm to the environment. Campaign group Harpenden and Sky believes the impact of carbon dioxide, the largest greenhouse gas, is not being addressed by Luton Airport or Luton Borough Council as part of the airport's expansion plans. The Borough Council is proposing to expand the airport to accommodate 32 million passengers per year, which campaigners fear will increase pollution from the associated traffic. St Albans Green Councillor Simon Grover said Luton Airport and the Borough Council are completely ignoring the major sources of pollution from the airport operations, namely the planes on the ground and the cars bringing people to and from the airport. It's essential that the authorities measure this pollution and act to reduce it. Harpenden Sky has accused the Borough Council of not measuring the road traffic impact on CO2 levels and said that the Council's airport company, London Luton Airport Limited, LLAL, annual monitoring report only refers to particulates and nitrogen dioxide generated on site, which are a relatively small contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. For National Clean Air Day last month, however, LLAL announced that they have commissioned an air quality monitoring supersite in Wigmore Park, which will monitor a greater range of air pollutants than any other UK airport. These include nitric oxide, carbon monoxide, sulphur dioxide and more, but not carbon dioxide. Councillor Andy Malcolm, chair of LLAL, said, We're absolutely committed to developing our proposals in the right way, in particular by making sure that our strategies for minimising and mitigating environmental impacts are the very best they can be, and fully consulting with communities. We have already brought into operation the most comprehensive air quality monitoring of any major UK airport, and separately are working to complete the £225 million Luton DART that will significantly improve the rail journey to London Luton Airport and deliver a step change in how passengers get to and from the terminal, with the aim of reducing the proportion of journeys undertaken by private cars.
This next article is about one actress who's going to star as all the characters in a new film. A St Albans director is fundraising to create her first feature film in which one actress plays every character. The Killings at Nurseries House is a black comedy murder mystery starring Catherine Rodden as all the parts, six different people who are often on screen simultaneously. Using transformative makeup and prosthetics, Catherine's roles include an old man, twins, a young male Eton graduate, and a burly cook. The film is being directed by St Albans local Emily Atwood under her production company, RAR, that's R-A-A-R, films alongside an as-yet uncast body double, soundman Oliver Atwood, and makeup artist Molly Dixon. Emily needs £7,000 for costumes, props, makeup, camera and lighting equipment, and Kickstarter fees. The 29-year-old said, "You don't need $1 million and a million different people to make a film. One actress, one stand-in and three crew. Why overcomplicate things?" The Killings at Nurseries House is being filmed in July and August at Emily's granddad's former home in Devon. She explained, "After my granddad died last New Year, 1 a.m, he really knew how to start a party. His house without him seemed sad and too melancholic, so I thought, why not make a film in it? To do something good with it and to, in a weird way, preserve the house and his memories." Emily, who was a University of Hertfordshire film and TV production graduate, said her grandfather massively supported her projects. In the past, she has co-directed a 10-minute tragic love story called Late Night at the Movies, and produced a feature film called The Snare, which was distributed on Netflix and Amazon. Emily added, "I'm both terrified and ridiculously excited about filming. I think just because we're such a tiny crew, it will have its own challenges, as I'll have to do about 5 jobs, but it just means I'll have to work longer and prep more." She thanked all the cast and crew. "I'm very, very lucky that these incredible people have not only put up with my crazy idea, but are actually enabling me. My family has also been amazing, lending me money, investing in the film, and just putting up with me and feeding me."
Brother Clement celebrates his glorious 90th birthday at St Columba's College. And there's a picture of Brother Clement carrying a cake with a candle with 90 on it. Not 90 candles, just a candle saying 90. And he does look very well for 90. A brother of the Catholic Church who has worked at a St Albans school for 64 years has celebrated his 90th birthday. Brother Clement refounded St Columba's College in 1955 after it was bought by the Brothers of the Sacred Heart. He arrived on the Queen Mary at Southampton Docks in 1955, along with his fellow founders, Brother Peter, Brother Eugene and Brother Victor. Since then, Brother Clement has completed 70 years as a Brother of the Sacred Heart, more than 60 years at the school and 25 years as a tour guide and canon at St Albans Cathedral. During that time, St Columba's College has grown from having 55 pupils to 820, and Brother Clement has seen more than 6,000 pupils pass through the school. To celebrate his 90th birthday on Saturday, June the 29th, the school held a weekend of celebrations, including a mass, dinner and a family barbecue. Guests included former and current staff, pupils and parents. MP Connor Burns, who attended the school when Brother Clement was headmaster, took part in the celebrations and passed on a personal message of congratulations from Prime Minister Theresa May. Michael Fox, a pupil from Brother Clement's first class in 1955, said, I remember the arrival of Brother Clement coming to teach us in what is now the headmaster's office. It was so exciting to be taught by this clever young American who seemed to be an expert in so many subjects, but also gave us a love for nature, sport, the church, and even housework and gardening. Brother Clement, who has worked at the school as both a teacher and headmaster, continues to work every day managing the school's archives. He also gives each pupil who arrives at St Columba's an induction on the school's values of courage, courtesy and compassion. Headmaster David Buxton said St Albans has become Brother Clement's adopted home. He has inspired generations of pupils over the years, helping to deliver the primary mission of the Brothers of the Sacred Heart in creating young men of faith, hope and love. He is esteemed and respected by very many families in and outside of the college, and we were delighted to thank him for his service and dedication to the school.
The last piece is a feature piece about Africa with the headline 7 days to the top of the world. A determined mental health campaigner ascended to the peak of Africa's highest mountain to raise awareness for causes close to her heart. Mum of two, Stacey Turner, aged 40, founder of the It's Okay to Say campaign, scaled the slopes of Kilimanjaro with the dual aim of promoting better mental health and raising funds for Cancer Research UK, CRUK. She launched It's Okay to Say in partnership with the Hearts Advertiser to encourage people of all ages to speak out about mental illness, confide in others and surround themselves with supportive networks, and has just finished applying for charity status. Stacey said she was inspired to climb the 16,100-foot mountain after watching the 2009 comic relief ascent and was accompanied by her friend Claire Delaney, who works as a fundraising manager for CRUK. The ascent took 7 days to complete, with the final push from base camp to the summit completed in just 7 hours. Unfortunately, high winds meant her group's time on Uhuru Peak was limited by high winds, and they faced further 5 hours travelling back to the ground. She told her Hearts ad, "Reaching camp each night was something to celebrate. It was amazing how quickly I started adapting myself. My perspective changed daily, grounding myself mindfully immersed in the pure beauty and ever-changing terrain. Kilimanjaro National Park is truly magnetic. I adored getting to know the guides, slowing down deliberately to listen intently to their tales of growing up in the local villages. You really learn the meaning behind it takes a village to raise a child, feeling helpless with their hardship. I knew my limits daily and adapted myself accordingly with the help of my guides. On a good day, I was stubbornly determined to carry my own bag, and others I had to give in and was forced to let them carry for me. Your well-being becomes their utmost importance, taking great pride in ensuring all your needs are met. Nothing is too much trouble. Together, the guides and the porters become part of your Kilimanjaro family, roughing it and toughing it with you, ready to catch you if you fall, lending a hand or often a shoulder when I felt unsteady. There were some moments when I thought it will be a miracle if I make it. I would acknowledge it, adjust my kit, my thoughts, and mindfully focus on my breathing. And there are other moments where I walked ahead crying and I couldn't turn to face anyone. There were moments when I lagged deliberately, not wanting this extraordinary and life-changing journey to end, and there were moments where I celebrated quietly, and many, many moments I embraced the magic of this legendary mountain on my mission to summit. I had heard of the amount of people that don't make it to the summit, but for me, Kilimanjaro had become my holy grail. I had been running on nervous and emotional energy in the lead-up, overwhelmed at all the support, swinging between pure motivation and crippling disbelief. But I was finally packed and ready to go. The anticipation of saying goodbye to my girls for 10 days was getting to me, with the reality of this huge mission I was on. What was I doing? I was chasing freedom. Entering Kilimanjaro National Park through Makami Gate was emotional. I remember taking a big breath in and out, nervously thinking, this is it. 40 kilometres to Uhuru Peak. Make each step count. The trek began through the beautiful rainforest. It was hot and I quickly learnt the words poli poli, meaning slowly, slowly, along with sippy sippy to encourage you to drink as much as possible. I thought I was doing well drinking my water. However, it came to light that I hadn't really drank that much from my bladder, and I was already beginning to suffer with the altitude. I had suffered a little from travel sickness, partly due to an 8-hour layover in Nairobi, so I was making an extra effort to drink as much as I could manage. I was immediately shocked at the weight the porters carried on their backs and heads. It felt unfair and unjust. Yet they were always so happy and smiling and saying hello, jambo jambo, as they powered by. The next day was slow and steady through the forest and climbing up over the rocks. It was one of my favourite days, though tough. I could have clambered like that all day, but the terrain seemed to open as if the beginning was over in preparation for the rest of the week. Arriving at camp early afternoon, I almost immediately snuggled down in my sleeping bag and fell fast asleep. The effects of the altitude were pressing in on me, with a constant pressure in my head, nausea and dizziness with the sun and cloud already below us. My reward was waking to the gorgeous sounds of the porters and guides chanting and singing just before dinner. I thought I'd been dreaming and stumbled out of my tent to be greeted by this melodious harmony below a stunning sunset. The following day, waking to an alluring sunrise, I sat, freezing cold, perched on a rock, a real pinch-yourself moment. I had barely slept, was sore, and knowing the day was going to be a long one. The ground was gravelly and rocky, with Uhuru Peak in the distance in all its grandeur. It was harsh, yet glorious as we came across waterfalls before reaching camp. Barranco Camp was at 3,900 metres and sat just below the magnificence of Uhuru. It was like a platform, a huge ravine where we were surrounded by valley-like views sweeping out over the clouds and the great Barranco Wall. I was quite nervous the following day as we were climbing up the Barranco Wall, and after the last few days my thighs were burning. My appetite wasn't great and I was desperately missing home and feeling the impact of the thin air. The trek was misty and extremely rocky with charred land. Grateful to arrive at camp and have a cup of tea, I enjoyed yet another soothing sunset. I was beginning to get into a habit now of managing my altitude sickness, falling asleep to the waves of nausea. Wipes had become my best friend and I had almost given up brushing my hair. And the next day, we were on our way to base camp. It was a short trek, and like a giddy kipper, burning legs and all, I dragged myself along for those few hours, knowing that at midnight I would be leaving in my attempt to summit. I had managed to get some reception and call home, bursting into tears, and I said, if I don't summit, I am simply grateful to have made it this far. Taken by the view in my emotional glory, I sat high on rocks, appreciating and holding on to this moment. I had chosen music to softly play on my ears to be able to listen to it again on my return home. We stumbled out into the starry darkness and began our weave up a steep slope with everyone else. I ended up on my own with my guide Jumani, almost taking one step forward for every two steps back. It was the only way I was going to make it, and I knew I had to pace myself. And so, with the crunch of footsteps in the snow and the glow of head torches, I touched the Mount Kilimanjaro sign at Uhuru Peak at 5:21 a.m. Just completely overwhelmed, I listened as Jumani explained that it was too dangerous to stay long because of the high winds. We started making our way back and had to take cover. We were both so windswept and tired. We reached a point on the way back where, linking arms, we could almost slide down. It was like skiing. By the time we reached the bottom, we still had several hours to trek back to camp, and for the last two, we seemed to gather our own little entourage. It's going to take a while to recover. Enduring this climb took me to my physical and mental limits. Yet with gravel still in my hand from a fall that has been treated for infection, and with continued effects physically and mentally, I'd do it all over again in a heartbeat, but maybe I'd tweak some bits. And the article is accompanied by pictures of intrepid Stacey surrounded by the beautiful landscape of Kilimanjaro.
Now we come to the names of people who have recently died, as published in this week's Hearts Advertiser. Emma Johnson, aged 88. James Woodward, aged 74. Ray Foster, aged 90, and Sean Goodchild, aged 55. May they rest in peace.
to the radio listings for the coming week.
We begin with those programmes serialised from Monday to Friday. The Book of the Week on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. and repeated at 12:30 a.m. is The Largest Remarkable Life of the Skin by Dr. Monty Lyman, who tells the story of our largest and fastest growing organ. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 7:45 p.m. is The Moon, which is the story of Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong and Michael Collins and their moon landing using NASA transcripts. The Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at noon is James McMillan. The continuation of David Nicholls' novel, Sweet Sorrow, read by James Norton, is at 12:04 p.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 10:45 p.m. Tales from the Lobby continues at 1:45 p.m. when Michael Crick looks at the beginning of political lobbying. For Terry Pratchett fans, Radio 4 Extra at 6 p.m. as an adaptation of Good Omens, which offers a different take on Armageddon. At 8 p.m, daily on Classic FM, the Full Works Concert brings a potpourri of popular classical music. It's worth mentioning that each weekday afternoon on Radio 2, three presenters take you through to early evening with slightly different programmes. At noon to 2, Jeremy Vine has topical discussion plus music. At 2 p.m, Steve Wright offers chats, listening interaction, big name guests and old and new chart hits, followed at 5 p.m. by Sarah Cox with chat and music. This will give you a relaxed listening without having to change channels. Listening choices for Saturday the 13th of July start at 2:30 p.m. on Radio 4 when the notorious and very funny National Theatre of Brent bring us The First Men on the Moon and How They Done It. This is one of the less serious contributions to the 50th anniversary of the moon landings. More drama this time on Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m. when Michael Denison and Dulcie Gray star in the 1938 play Dear Octopus. This is followed at 5:30, still on Radio 4 Extra, by Jarvis and Matthew Hanging In, when Martin Jarvis and Christopher Matthew share memories of the life in the 60s. Verdi's great opera, Othello, is broadcast from the Royal Opera House at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Archive on 4 at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 has The Voice in the Machine, which looks at automated voices from the speaking clock to Siri.
Sunday the 14th of July is lunchtime listening at 1:30 p.m. on Radio 4 has The Country versus the City. Chris Mason examines the divide between multicultural cities and the slower, more conservative countryside. The 3 p.m. drama on Radio 4 is the first of three episodes of Renaissance Man, The Last Judgment of Giorgio Vasari. The painter, architect and biographer is tasked with painting the ceiling of Florence Cathedral by Cosimo de' Medici, and he prays for assistance. Another offering for the moon landing anniversary is on Radio 3 at 5:30 in Words and Music, The Moon, with poetry and music from Larkin, Auden and Dickinson, Beethoven and Chopin, amongst others. A complete contrast follows at 6:45, still on Radio 3, when the Sunday feature is Cold War in Full Swing, Louis Armstrong in the GDR. In 1964, Louis Armstrong is the first US entertainer to play live jazz on East German soil. At 9 p.m. on Classic FM, Catherine Bott continues her exploration of the four elements in music, this week, fire. Monday the 15th of July brings us 4-4, Introduction and Allegro, a comedy drama about a string quartet. This is at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Beyond Belief at 4:30 p.m. on Radio 4 looks at the relationship between religion, creativity and imagination. Some diverse and interesting programmes can be heard on Radio 4 this evening, starting at 8 p.m. with The Unexpected History of Clean Eating, which is apparently the diet of the moment. A Touch of Politics appears at 8:30 p.m. in Analysis, when Edward Stoughton looks at how big political parties disappear and what happens when they do. And then at 9 p.m, Remorse, A Sorry Story, in which the role of remorse in criminal sentencing is examined.
On to Tuesday, July 16th, starting with Making Plans with Nigel, the 2:15 p.m. drama on Radio 4. Set at the time of the EU referendum, a writer and IT nerd finds a lump in his breast. At 3:30 p.m. again on Radio 4, the wonderful Peter White starts a new series of No Triumph, No Tragedy. He interviews people in public life with a disability. Followed by 4 p.m. by Michael Rosen with Word of Mouth, exploring the word the. In tune at 5 p.m. on Radio 3 has a live performance of Purcell's Fairy Queen with accompanying discussion. And John Finnemore, the comic writer and performer, looks back at his life and career so far in Telling Tales on Radio 4 Extra at 9 p.m. On to Wednesday, July 17th, starting early at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 with Soul Music. This week, Ralph McTell discusses the rather marvellous Streets of London on its 50th anniversary. The comedy about four women living together, All Those Women, continues on Radio 4 at 11:30 a.m. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 at 2 contains music by Gershwin and Elgar. And the folk show with Mark Radcliffe is on at 9 o'clock on Radio 2. While on Radio 4 at the same time, there is Stranger Than Sci-Fi, when a comedian and an astrophysicist discover real-life science that sounds too strange to be true.
For Thursday the 18th of July, from our own correspondent at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is always fascinating listening. Opera is on offer at 2 p.m. on Radio 3 when Smetana's The Bartered Bride is brought to you from Munich. In the Dangerous Visions drama series at 2:15 on Radio 4, Perimeter is about a city divided by a giant electrified fence. Open Country at 3 p.m, still on Radio 4, takes us to Swaffham in Norfolk to find out how a group of volunteers are helping to create a garden full of monsters for the Chelsea Flower Show. Tea Time Comedy Listening on Radio 4 Extra starts with Bristow, and then at 5 p.m. with Hobby Bobbies, and then at 5:30 p.m. Terry Alderton's Whole Half Hour. The serialisation of Good Omens continues at 6 p.m, and there's a change of mood at 6:30 p.m. with Great Lives, Arthur Conan Doyle, and then back to comedy with Brothers-in-Law. The comedy slot at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is Welcome to Wherever You Are, featuring comedians from around the world. A more serious note is struck at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 in the series Making History, Bloodlines, in which bloodlines from the Queen's surprising ancestors to the vagaries of dog breeding are discovered. Friday the 19th of July, the last day of our listening week, brings us at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 a one-off comedy, British Troll Farm, set in a secret military unit dedicated to fighting the social media cyber war. An old favourite, The Interrogation, returns at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Detectives Matthews and Armstrong interview a friend who is also a police officer. Another programme about political lobbying is at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, but this time it's a comedy called Lobbyland, where a young political editor tries to make sense of the madness engulfing British politics. Today sees the start of the BBC Proms, and the first concert is broadcast at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. It includes a new commission celebrating the moon landing and ends with Janáček's Glagolitic Mass. I hope you enjoy your listening week.
We've now come to the end of this recording. So from Liz, John, Alison and me, Jenny, and from Alex, who recorded and edited this edition, and Angela, who chose the radio selections, goodbye, and here's to the next time.